le matin, le cœur, who wants to have me down? But le matin, le cœur, who wants to show me around? Under my thumb.
Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Danny Stevens and Mickey Stevens from the band Danny's Reasons. Today is May 1st. 2010, and I'm talking with Danny Stevens and Mickey Stevens from Danny's Reasons. Let's start out, and I'm going to ask both of you your full name, date of birth, and hometown, please.
Danny H. Stevens is my name. I was born in Joplin, Missouri. July 18th is my birthday. The year, oh, I can't go there. I moved to Minneapolis when I was young, and the rest is history.
Mickey?
Mine is Michael Stevens, better known as Mickey. I was born May 9th, 1945, 2 years younger than Danny. And I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, okay, the day after the Germans surrendered.
Wow. What part of town do you guys grow up in and go to high school in?
South Minneapolis. West High.
School. Yeah. West High. What year did you graduate?
62.
62?
63.
Okay. And what part of town did you live in?
Lake and Hennepin. Lake of the Isles.
Give me a little bit of an idea of what's going on during this time period in Minneapolis as far as music overall goes. What's going on? What's happening?
Back
in the early days.
In the early days.
Early 60s.
At that time, before we hit the, let's call it the revolution of garage bands, there was a big surge of music going on from Augie Garcia playing at the Club 26, and I'd go watch him.
Where was that located?
On Hennepin. It's the old Green Mill on approximately 26th and Hennepin. Mm-hmm. You had Peter, Paul, and Mary playing at the Padded Cell.
The folk band?
Yes. And I would see those groups. Now,
where was the Padded Cell?
That would be on Lake Street and the Colfax, mm-hmm, just before Bryant.
Okay, so that's a folk club.
At that time, it doesn't exist, I don't think, anymore.
Would Augie Garcia be one of the first rock bands from Minneapolis?
It was Roscoe and the Green Men.
Okay.
That most people don't even remember, but they had green hair, and they turned out to be very, very, very big.
Where did you see them play?
A jockey club owned by Dave Rackner and his father, which was on Hennepin, and later that became the Roaring Twenties, and we played at more downstairs.
Mm-hmm. You guys are going out in your high school years seeing these bands play.
Right.
Right.
And mine was Danceland, going to see the Beach Boys, and that was one of the first places the Rolling Stones played.
Right. Now, the Beach Boys were there in 1963. I have heard that that place was packed.
It was there.
Every time.
Yeah. We knew Big Reggie real well. Mm-hmm. How I originally met Big Reggie before he got into the music is he was the head of the amusement park, Excelsior Amusement Park. Mm-hmm. Well, he had contacted me and asked if we could put on a water ski show there. And he wanted to do it because at that time I had placed extremely high. I think I was second in the world for boys jumping and things like that. And so we started putting it together, and then he had heard that I started in the music field and was saying maybe we should use Danceland as a place for local groups. Because at that time, at Excelsior Amusement Park, he was using national groups. I'd see the Everly Brothers there quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I was dating at that time Dee Dee of Dick and Dee Dee. that had the mountains high.
But she was from Los Angeles.
Yes. Her aunt knew my aunt very well. And when, see, people forget how powerful Minneapolis was in the music field, as Danny Johnson knows from Joker's Wild, that Amos Heilertier and David Lieberman controlled over 60% of the distribution. Well, back in that day, they were even more powerful, and groups would have to come here to get their records on jukeboxes placed in their music stores.
So Dick and Dee Dee came here?
Yes. And Dee Dee a lot. And
as promo, to do promo, or?
I believe so. I think that's fair. And also relaxing.
Okay. So you were both there the night the Beach Boys played at Excelsior?
I was for...
I was, yeah. They were trying to crawl in through the windows and every way you could. It was hundreds of kids outside that couldn't get in.
When the Beach Boys played live, did they sound like their records or different?
I thought they did. I was a guest of Reggie, Big Reggie, mm-hmm. and I thought they did a good job.
Yeah.
Because remember, most groups didn't have that much harmony at the time.
Was Brian Wilson there on that trip?
I believe they all were, because I did see the father. I thought the father was there, something like Reggie, I thought, pointed out and said that's their father, because they were young then.
They were about our age.
Yeah.
Or a little bit older.
But no, but I mean when they were performing, yeah. Whether we were young or not, they were young.
So are you listening to WDGY or KDWB or both at this time?
Mostly, for me, WDGY.
Same. I liked Bill Deal. Mm-hmm. Back then, and there was somebody else. Sam Sherwood, was he on at that time?
He was KDWB.
Yeah, I listened to him a little, but I'm not sure if it was during the Beach Boy era. But I did listen to him a lot.
When did you put your first band together?
We were called Danny and the Night Sounds. Well, I have to take that back. It was the first band was Danny and the Diamonds, and we played at the prom on the Midway.
What year would this have been?
60, 61. And we did a thing with Joey D and the Starlighters. Dick Clay was a good friend, along with Tim Kerr. And then later, I formed the group to be called Danny and the Night Sounds.
Okay, your very first band, do you...
The first band that was a band could have been called Danny and the Night Sounds.
And who was in the band?
The Swenson Brothers, myself... And I can't think of the other person's name, but we got together and we won the Teenage Fair Band Contest.
At the Minneapolis
State Fair, yeah, John Knodel during the Teen Fair. Mm-hmm. And John Knodel was running, and I think he was with Capitol Records, and we had won. And through John Knodel, he said, why don't you form your own group? And you got Reasons and whatever, and he said, that's how we became Danny's Reasons.
Is that why you're still in high school?
I think I was a senior, yeah.
So it would have been 63.
Yeah, about 63.
When the band starts out.
In fact, we won. Yeah, we won the contest 63 at the State Fair. It was, yeah. It was
and 63. You also played for our high school graduation in 63.
Yeah. So.
Do you remember any other bands who were part of that contest at the State Fair?
Well, the Morticians, I think, were there. It started out with... The contest was like 500 bands.
Yeah. All local?
All local.
So it had to be like the Accents and the Underbeats?
Nope, they were not on it. It was not any groups that later had records like Joker's Wild, the Underbeats, or any of them. I never heard of the groups later. Mm-hmm. But John Knodel had it where they played all the time. And we were on WCCO with Bill Carlson every day at the State Fair.
Playing live?
Yeah, we'd play on their stage, and he'd go back there. And the person that would really know the whole thing would be John Knodel. I mean, and at that time, he was the director or regional director of Capitol Records.
And he comes up with the name Danny's Reasons.
He suggested it, and Mickey did. And
CDU.
Yeah, C.D. Van Dusen and...
Who's that now?
C.D. Van Dusen at the time was our drummer. He came up, you know, also. It was sort of a conglomeration of all of us.
Hmm. Okay, so who's in the first version of Danny's Reasons?
Mickey Stevens.
On?
He was the gimmick and tambourine.
Conga and maracas.
CeeDee Van Dusen, drummer. Frank Marino, lead guitar. Oh,
The drummer. Who was the drummer?
CeeDee Van Dusen.
Okay.
Frank Marino, guitar. Bob Gagne, bass guitar.
Bass.
And myself.
Did you sing primarily, or did you play instruments?
I played the organ at that time and sang, and then finally it was Frank and them that, after we, in 66, had met the Doors, we were playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go, and they were at the London Fog, he said, you should go out in the front, Danny, and that's how it all started, because at the Teenage Fair, I was strictly out in the front.
That would be the summer of 63.
I believe it was,
at
yes.
the State Fair, where the band really comes together?
Right.
Okay.
Where the idea starts happening.
Okay. And do you start playing then the clubs, local clubs?
Just a few high school jobs. Because you had, in our era of starting, you had three places you could play. High schools, teen gigs, and nightclubs. In our case, I sort of push the group towards the society, trying to be like a Eddie Duchin / Peter Duchin.
I'm not sure I follow you. What do you mean?
Playing the society gigs like for the Daytons, the Heffelfingers, because they didn't really allow their kids to go to the Magoos, the Luckies, and those places.
You're talking about private parties.
Yes.
Almost, yeah, like that. But at like the Minneapolis Club. Dayton's private upstairs.
So your option was to go in a little different direction than
what
the
you
other
saw.
Bands.
Right. I wanted to go after the media. The media was controlled by the society. And I got that from Bill Carlson from WCCO and Nancy Nelson, who used to be on Channel 11. Mm-hmm. Originally, I met Nancy Nelson on Channel 9 when they had Date with Dino, which was a teen show. And we became one of their groups that they used a lot.
Where was that filmed?
At the Fauché Tower.
And when was it aired? Was it live or?
It was live. Well, they may have kept videos of it, but I wasn't aware of that.
Did you play it? But the bands played live on the show?
Yes.
Who was Dino?
I just knew him from there. I never saw him appear in any of our other events that dealt with music.
He was the host.
Yeah, he was the host, and you never saw him on any other channel after that show stopped.
And
that,
was Nancy Nelson live on the show as well?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
I think that was her first break.
Date with Dino strictly featured local bands.
Mm-hmm. There might have been once or twice an artist here or there that was national, but... And I can't even tell you what the format was. It was so long ago.
Do you know if any videos exist of that show today?
No, I don't.
Looking back, that seems like a very wise decision on your part to play for these society-type parties and connect with media people. You're right out of high school, right?
Right. But I, as Mickey says, I was one hell of a promoter. And all through my life.
Well, and at that time, too, we never had to use Central Booking, which was Dick Shapiro or Marsh. They would contact us, and everybody else had to sign exclusively with one or the other. And we just said, Danny said, no, we're not going to sign with you guys. If you want us, you get a commission. We'll give you a commission, but we're not going to be exclusive to you.
At this time, there's a number of local bands who are becoming quite popular. The Accents, the Avanis, the Underbeats, the Trashmen. Were you going out and seeing these guys play?
Yes.
Did you have a favorite band or a musician from
Joker's Wild.
That's later.
No, but I never did up to that point. As I told Danny before we started this interview, my favorite group, and... It's very hard for me to like a lot of groups. Not that they're not good, but I'm more of a gimmick type person. So what jumps out at me, it's not how great their harmony is. Because the Underbeats had, with Jim Johnson and them, they had great harmony, great vocals. It was just something unique. And the only group that really jumped out at me was the Joker's Wild. A three-piece group sounding that full was rare.
and a little bit of a show.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a little bit later in time. So you start playing these society parties, and you're on Date with Dino.
Mm-hmm.
What happens next with Danny's Reasons?
Bill Carlson jumped on board and said, we want to do you on TV. So we started doing a lot of WCCO. Then Nancy Nelson, back around that time, started with Channel 11. Warren Martin. She said, Danny, we'd like you over on this, our show, too. So it started building. And then I became, by doing some of the society things, I became familiar with Bruce Dayton, Stuart Wells, who was CEO of Dayton Hudson, and his right-hand man that later became CEO, Carl Erickson. One thing led to another. They used to have college night, where every floor at Dayton had a band of some type of music, and they would show their new fall fashions and this and that, and it was free pop, free food, but they would draw thousands of people. So I was sitting with Stuart, and I think Bruce Dayton might have been there, but for sure Carl Erickson also. And I said, you want to really move clothes? I'll show you how I'll do it, but I want to control what groups you use. And they were interested. And I said, get an eighth floor. They already had something like an eighth floor auditorium, but at that time, the eighth floor was still appliances, a pet store, and that. I said, you'll have thousands of kids here on Saturday that'll take the buses. They did, and it became very, very successful. So that brought me more into the society that, hey, we better listen to them.
Do you recall the first band that played Dayton's Eighth Floor?
Us. Every time we
were played. We're in the 1960-something annual report of Dayton's.
So that would have been 63, 64?
Or 65. 64, 65 within that period of the annual report. But we had played before that annual report had come out.
And so, we would play every time there was an eighth floor. Every time they would have that show, we were always eighth floor because we would always draw the most.
Because that held the most people.
Yes.
Right.
So you start developing a following now, I would
that
guess.
Way, yes, the teen things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what forced Bob Rosen, or Rosen, whatever it is, and Gary Jorgensen to start having us at Lucky's and Magoo's. Now, they switched us over to Magoo's a lot because we had both the younger crowd that could sit on one side and the older crowd that could drink their beer on the other side.
Okay, so you're playing the Dayton shows. What other local clubs do you play at?
The Vincent Van Gogh, which was written up in Playboy magazine as one of the top five clubs in the United States.
We were the
States.
House band there.
Is this before Mr. Lucky's?
Yes.
Yes. This would be 64 for sure. And that was owned by Stan Clinton. And
next door was the Red Baron.
Yeah. So that area at one time was the nightclub area where you went from Buster's, which is across from First National Bank or U.S. Bank or something was across the street. But you went from Buster's across the street to the Vincent Van Gogh to the Red Baron, and then there was another club right around the corner.
Lines and lines of people waiting to get in.
Okay, so you're playing...
Was it the Bradfords that was down on the corner?
That was near there, the Bradfords, later.
Okay, so you're playing there, and... what other local clubs?
By the way, the Vincent Van Gogh and the Red Baron, going east a half a block, is the new courthouse.
Hmm.
That's where it was. It's across from the old Pillsbury brand new building.
Pillsbury Center?
In Pillsbury Center.
Okay.
The teen places in high school, we'd take off a weekend from Stan Clinton's place.
And that was mostly your arenas, your Aldridge Arena and stuff like that. And he had a set that he was better than Mick Jagger as for a show set, and we would just come out and blast it and then play one set and then disappear into the nightclubs.
And Mr. Lucky's evolved into a different club at some point?
Yeah. They called the new, I forgot the name, but it was New City Opera later, and then Magoo's.
Okay. So during this time period, I assume you're picking up more fans along the way and
right.
developing
both adults
a following.
And kids, yeah.
How many kids would show up for one of your gigs at Dayton's 8th Floor Auditorium?
800-900.
And they brought in national acts there too, right, at some
yes.
point?
Yes, mm-hmm. down the road.
Did you see any national bands there?
Yep.
Who did you see?
Well, I can't remember the names of them.
Mickey, remember any?
The New Beats, I think. Were they the New Beats? We Like Peanut Butter.
Bread and Butter.
It's hard to tell because we played with so many national groups that you know the timing gets mixed up.
Does the band wear costumes or matching outfits at this point?
We had a Beatle look. Later, we got into a Rolling Stone look and then went beyond that. But I'll tell you, one of the models at the Dayton's thing was Nick Nolte.
Nick Nolte, the
actor.
Actor. And they had a British clothing store there too.
Yeah.
Carnaby Street?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, 1964, the Rolling Stones come to Excelsior, Reggie's Ballroom.
Yep.
Reggie's Dance Land. Were you guys there for that?
Yes.
I was. Yes. And they.
You too?
Mm-hmm.
They almost had to pay people to come in and see them.
How many people showed up?
Not many at all. And that's the night that Mick Jagger got in a fight and said he would never come back to Minneapolis. Mm-hmm.
And they egged him. Oh, we saw all that. Tim Kerr was driving him off in the station wagon while they were throwing eggs at him.
This is after the show?
After the show. But the main headliner was Mike Wagner and the Bops. And that was a favorite act of Big Reggie at the time. Mike Wagner. And he should get more credit than he has got, in my personal opinion, because he was the start of what I called the modern rock and roll.
Mike Wagner and the Bops.
Mm-hmm. And he drew very well. That was a period where we were starting to get our following. He had a following.
Where did you see that band play?
Excelsior a lot. St. Michael's, they had a ballroom we played. Up in Detroit Lakes, I saw him play up there. And then Stu Kloner used to, when he promoted a lot of national acts, used to have us on that show. And that's how we got a chance to meet Mike Wagner. I don't think Stu used him more than maybe once on one of his shows, but with that we played with Little Eva, Big D Irwin, Joey D and the Starlighters. There's a host of stars. Like Mickey said, we've played with so many, probably more than most of the acts here because of the connections that would say, oh, we better add Danny's Reasons onto this show. Not that we were a major draw or anything like that. It was just one more added thing, and they knew they could work with us on price because we were, again, after promotion and publicity.
Tell me some of the songs the band would have been playing at this initial time period, 63, 64, 65. What was your song list like?
Get Off My Cloud.
A lot of Rolling Stones.
Yeah. I liked him. The problem when Mickey said that I did more showmanship in the beginning days than Mick, what he meant, there was a big conflict going on between Brian Jones and Mick, and we even saw it at Danceland. Brian, as Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts have said, was the leader of the Rolling Stones. Mick and Keith were moving him out the door. You could see that coming. So you really never knew who was the front man of the group in those days. But there was something very, very unique about the group that I liked. I caught on, and I thought, well, at least in this area, I'm going to grab on to that.
Brian Jones was more of a flamboyant onstage personality.
Little Lord Fauntleroy, that guy.
Compared to Mick Jagger.
Absolutely. Dress, everything. Yes. Mickey, that's where Mickey's, I felt, got the idea of his flamboyance on our group. Somebody is stable, plays the part, and Mickey becomes the flamboyant, wild person.
Okay, Mickey, I'm looking at a photo of you here. wearing apparently an aviator hat of some sort, yes, and goggles. Tell me about this outfit. Where did you come up with this outfit?
And well, part of it was what was happening at the time, and then part of it was probably me, where I, like I was saying, when I first started, I went through a bunch of different hats, and then I found the World War One flying helmet. And
where'd you find that hat?
Harris Warehouse, and I bought them out, and it just caught on. And with Danny and all that stuff, we liked a lot of write-ups. And if you notice from the first Connie Awards and stuff like that, they were always writing about us, because we were the first ones that came. Everybody else was in tuxedos, and we came dressed like we did. And we would get all the write-ups in the paper.
In fact, we have a copy of the first Connie Awards book, and the whole book is almost about us, because that was the way Connie Hector could get paper publicity, because the Cowells that owned the Star and Tribune, to the Pillsbury's, to the Dayton's, to the Heffelfingers that controlled the grain industry, they controlled what was going to be seen at that moment in time for music. And Dayton's did spend a lot of money on their advertising that. And again, which we'll show you, there was one whole section of the paper of us advertising that Carnaby Street clothing store of theirs, wearing their clothes.
And Mickey, I'm looking at a photo of you here, and you appear to be elevated from the ceiling. How did this work?
I was always doing weird things, and I think it was Danny that said, well, why don't you try hanging upside down? And so I did. And it did. I think it caught everybody's eye.
Well, the one time I said Will Jones is out there, who was the main writer at the time.
He loved us.
Versus CJ. I mean, CJ was too young.
You're talking about Star Tribune music.
Star and Tribune, right. So we lit him on fire for that time. Mm-hmm. And he looked at it, that's added. These things added. It was all attention get media.
We Bill Carlson loved us a lot, so he had us play on This Must Be the Place, and we had a song out, Play with Fire, and
written
I would set
Stones.
My tambourines on fire and, you know, stuff like that. And our band boy went out and got cotton balls for the tambourine, and I wasn't thinking at the time, so I was playing it, and the cotton balls started flying, and so the stage at WCCO caught on fire, and they wouldn't stop filming because they were doing the psychedelic thing, and it was coming off really super as it went on. And then, yeah.